Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Today's episode of Opening Arguments is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Head on over to ZipRecruiter.com/OA and you can try ZipRecruiter for free.
Your Honor, I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty. Oh.
They say a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 173. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is all of the other co-hosts on the show, Andrew Torres. I left the window open for just a few days for people to think there was another mystery co-host, but there isn't.
I like it when we have guests, but we don't have one today, so you'll just have to deal with me.
I can't wait to talk about this all foreign policy show. We can hear about the Iran deal and the end of the Korean War.
Yeah.
All right. Well, exciting stuff. We've got a lot of good stuff to talk about. Ooh, also a little bit of an update to the Berkeley lawsuit. We're going to find out the predictions. We're going to find out who was right, whether it was me, whether it was Andrew, or whether it was our esteemed guest on that episode all those many moons ago, Travis West. There's a reason I don't remember his name. Future guest of really terrible conferences. Anyway, okay, let's get to it. Lots to talk about.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe yourself.
Okay, so is this an Andrew was wrong? Is this a Travis was wrong? Or is this a Thomas was wrong segment? Let's find out.
So here's the status, right? Okay, particularly for our new listeners, back on episode 73.
We had Dunning-Kruger on the show.
So back in episode 73, we had Travis Wester on the show, who wanted to advance the argument that imposing the actual security costs on the event being held on the Berkeley campus for Ann Coulter and for other speakers was a violation of the First Amendment. At the conclusion, so go back if you're a new listener, you might want to listen to that episode. I think
if there's other episodes that you need to listen to first, listen to other episodes of the show. If you're totally out of episodes, it's interesting to hear someone who is very confident in their non-knowledge of the law try to argue with Andrew. It is an interesting experiment, so check it out. But I don't want to give the impression that it's like, you know, it was a frustrating episode. Anyway.
It's a non-typical show too.
Right,
that's right.
Right.
So at the end of the episode, we made a bunch of predictions about the fate of the Berkeley lawsuit, being the First Amendment claims being raised by Young Americans for Freedom, or I think they're now called the Young America Foundation. When back in the Stone Age, when I went to college, they were called Young Americans for Freedom.
They did that rebranding.
But they didn't change the acronym, so they're still YAF, which is, you know, to me sounds like a duck in heat, but whatever. Our concluding predictions were as follows. Mr. Wester predicted that this lawsuit was going to go to the
Supreme
Court.
Straight to the Supreme Court. Right. It was going all the way there.
Was going to be a manifest, new recognition of the rights of conservative organizations.
I think he even predicted Oliver Wendell Holmes would deliver the... No, maybe he didn't say that.
Thomas took the exact opposite position and said that it was going to be dismissed. It is not fair to say I split the baby in half. I split the baby in 1-99, which is to say I predicted that ultimately it would settle, but that I endorsed pretty much all of Thomas's reasoning. Since then, the lawsuit was dismissed once, but was dismissed with leave to amend, and the some of the plaintiffs amended the complaint. Berkeley filed another motion to dismiss, and that ruling came down a couple of days ago.
Ooh.
And I think it is it's vindication for me, but it is a vindication for the position that Thomas took. The case is going to proceed, but let me explain the incredibly narrow way in which it's going to proceed. And it will be spoilers on the grounds that I said, which is when a plaintiff files a complaint, the court is required to treat all of the allegations in that complaint as true, pending discovery. Right. And so you may or may not recall that the original lawsuit made two kinds of allegations about policies that were supposedly in effect at Berkeley. The thing that they challenged that was the subject of OA episode 73 is what we call the major events policy. It's referred to in this opinion as MEP. That is the policy that, among other things, required the larger controversial conservative events to be moved to more secure locations on campus and imposed the actual security costs in connection with that event on the groups that sponsored the event in the first place. Those were the two fundamental features that we discussed in episode 73. In addition to the MEP, the complaint also alleged what they called the high-profile speakers policy, which is, quote, an unwritten policy. This is from the exact language of the complaint, that it was a, quote, unwritten policy used to secretly place restrictions on conservative speakers on the Berkeley campus. So, the punchline. The only way in which this complaint is going forward as a First Amendment complaint, as a facial challenge, is on the basis of the high-profile speakers policy, the secret conspiracy unwritten thing for which they have no evidence exists and which Berkeley denies exists because it doesn't exist, because it's made up by Ann Coulter for PR nonsense.
So are you saying that this will go forward because they're forced to assume, the court is forced to assume that's true for the sake of
argument? There is a high-profile speaker policy. And look, if there is a this is why Travis Wester didn't even want to touch this, right? If there is a secret policy at Berkeley to bring on liberal speakers and not bring on conservative speakers, then yeah, of course that's viewpoint discrimination, right? I mean, it's sort of not worth arguing, but there's no evidence that such a policy exists. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence to the contrary, not including the fact that lots of conservatives have spoken on the Berkeley campus. There is one aspect of the MEP that is alleged that, again, turns on the facts, right? Separate from what we said on the show. Remember, the position that you and I defended on the show is it is perfectly consistent with the First Amendment and upheld by case law that a university can impose the actual costs of increased security for an event on the student organizations that bring a speaker to campus. There is a set of factual allegations. It's on page 15 to 16 of this complaint.
Was this on the original complaint or only on the revised one?
Only on the amended complaint.
Okay.
Right? But they allege, again, I have no idea the veracity of this. They allege that the security fee charged when Ben Shapiro was on campus was $15,738, and that that was, quote, approximately three times the amount charged for an event featuring Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor in the same facility in 2011, end of quote. Okay. So, and then the insinuation is, so you're not just charging the actual fees associated with using the building, but you're tacking on some kind of extra fee. Again, if that's true, I don't have any reason to believe that it is, but in a complaint, you assume that mm-hmm. the facts are true as pled. If that's true, then again, yes, that would be a First Amendment violation of discrimination as applied on a policy that this court has said is neutral, right? The major events policy, perfectly neutral, consistent with the First Amendment to impose the costs of the security. But if you're imposing extra costs, you're not imposing the cost of the security. That's what they're allowed to go forward and challenge. Everything else that does not fit into those two things, right? In other words, that are not either allegations of a secret conspiracy to keep conservatives off the Berkeley campus or allegations that they didn't really charge the security fees, they charged extra fees, again, in a way to keep conservatives off campus against conservative speakers that you don't do in a way against mainstream and liberal speakers. All of the rest of that got dismissed out.
And I think it's important to note that my memory is, I think we likely granted several times during that mess of an episode that, yeah, if there was some like unfair, you know, overcharging, you know, to try to keep conservatives out, then yeah, that would be something. But he was trying to claim that just charging for security, even if it's the actual cost, that's a violation of the First Amendment, right? Is that your right. memory
and
of it?
That is my memory. And so that's why this is a Thomas was right segment. I wanted to be clear, there is a lawsuit going forward, but it is a lawsuit only on those two limited things. One more thing I might add is that the claim for punitive damages was also dismissed, and the court said, and I think it's probably worth ending on this, plaintiffs have failed to plead facts sufficient to show that defendants were motivated by viewpoint discrimination or retaliatory animus. The First Amendment complaint contains no alternative factual basis for a finding of improper motive, nor does it allege any facts sufficient to show that defendants acted with reckless or callous indifference to plaintiffs' rights. So put all of that together. If there is a secret hidden policy that they're able to produce in discovery, or if there is some kind of improper allocation of an additional $5,000 to $10,000 in security fees that aren't related to the actual fee, that's the only thing left in this lawsuit.
And that's
for
fair.
Young
I mean,
America
if
Foundation.
That did yeah. happen, then yeah, you can't. You know,
then you should. Just, yeah. yeah, we would all. None of us took that position.
Right. Right.
So that's what's left. It's important to say there is a lawsuit out there, but
another thing. Raises so none of those issues. If they've dismissed the punitive component, like, does this mean if they were to even win, they would just get $5,000 to $10,000 back? Is that what that means?
Right. Or? They would get $5,000 plus they would get a declaration that you can't have a super secret, you know, double probation sure. policy of yeah. keeping conservatives off campus. And let's go back to all of that, right? Like, that's all what we said. So there you go. Thomas was right. And there's
thanks. It sounds like you were also right on the part. Well, if I remember right, I thought you were saying that they were going to settle just to get, you know, just frustrated me because I think then Travis latched onto that is like, oh yeah, they might just settle because it's such, you know, and that I remember being a little frustrated by that. But it sounds like they're not settling at least so far. And if they were only talking $5,000 to $10,000, it sounds like it's not even worth, you know, like that much time or that much, you know, effort out of Berkeley.
At this point, right, you are correctly stating that my first prediction was settle before moving forward. And that's wrong. The university filed two separate motions to dismiss,
good.
Prevailed in its entirety on the first one and prevailed in large measure on the second one. So you were far more correct than I was with respect to that.
If only I could apply that to bar exam questions. But anyway.
So there's okay. our update.
All right. Well, there you go. That's why you listen to experts and not people who Googled something once. All right. Let's talk about the Iran deal.
Yeah. So I think there are a bunch of really interesting legal questions with respect to the Iran deal. So first, let's start off with what it is. I'm going to link it, as always, in the show notes. It is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action signed in Vienna on July 14th, 2015. And it was by and between the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, China, France, Russia, the UK, and the US, and Germany, and an agreement between all of those parties on the one hand, and also with participation by the European Union and Iran on the other hand. And the preliminary implementation was, in large measure, was the United States would relax certain sanctions against Iran along with the other member nations. And in exchange for that, Iran would agree to a series of restrictions of permitting UN inspectors to look at its facilities that were designed to reduce the viability of the Iranian nuclear weapons program. I'm going to include a briefing from the Council on Foreign Relations that I think is really, really good in terms of breaking down what the deal did. But I'm going to read this one-line summary because I think it's important to understand the legal aspects. During the negotiations, the Obama administration said their stated goal of this deal was to set back Iran's nuclear program so that even if Iran were to sprint towards producing enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon, which is referred to in the agreement and in the discussions as the breakout time, that breakout time would be lengthened from in 2015, what they estimated as several weeks to over a year. And by every measure that I can tell, again, you know, our political biases are well known, that sort of thing, that appears to have been the case, right? So in other words, what the deal accomplished, as far as, and again, you know, you're proving a negative, was to take Iran from being in a spot where if they wanted to ramp up to develop a nuclear weapon, they could do so in several weeks, to now they're at a time where in order to process that much fissionable material would require more than a year. So in light of that, the first question that everybody has been asking me is, can Trump just withdraw from the treaty obligations, right? Right. And the answer to that is that this actually isn't a treaty. It's an interesting political arrangement, and I'm going to explain the reason why it's not a treaty in a minute. But it is a political arrangement between the member nations, subject to the underlying discretionary powers of those nations. So, in other words, under the authority granted by Congress, the president can relax or reinstate sanctions against Iran, and that's the negotiation that took place. So at the time that the deal was being concluded, then Kansas congressman, now current Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, sent a letter to the Obama administration asking them for the legal bases of the Iran deal. It's clear he's been hostile to it from the beginning. And the Obama administration replied, this is, and I'm going to link this in the show notes, These are the words of the Obama administration. The JCPOA, right, that is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is not a treaty or an executive agreement and is not a signed document. It reflects political commitments between Iran, the P5 plus one, the countries I described, and the European Union, end of quote. So it is very, very clear then that the JCPOA is not a formal treaty. The Obama administration disclaimed any rights in the document as a treaty. If it were a treaty, right, that would be governed by Article 2 of the Constitution, and it would require advice and consent of the Senate, which the Obama administration would not have been able to get in 2015. And so They only had support of 42 senators. The reason they only had support of 42 senators is because not only did all the Republicans line up reflexively against it but because this issue also tends to bring along Democrats who are hardliners about Israel. So lots of Democratic politicians align with the what might more loosely be termed the neocon wing of the Republican Party when it comes to Israel questions. So he only had 42 votes. As a result, this deal never had to be submitted to Congress, did not have to go before the advice and consent of the Senate. There were two resolutions of disapproval that were passed that also have no legally binding effect. But at the end of the day, so
then this really isn't even anything.
What even is it? Well, what it is it represents the commitments of those governments to...
Well, but for them, what... I mean, okay, so you were talking about the U.S. Was it any more formalized
by the other governments? It is more formalized in the other member nations. And I should add that internationally, in my view, this constitutes a treaty. And this has to do with the distinction between what counts as a treaty for purposes of Article 2 of the Constitution, which this clearly doesn't, and a prior treaty to which the United States is a signatory, right? So so there's sort of an inception of treaty here, right? That is the 1969 Vienna Convention on Treaties, right? Which I will also link in the show notes. The internal government report on this is several hundred pages long. The Vienna Convention is at page 384. So never let it be said, I don't do work for you people. On page 384, Article 2, Section 1A of the Vienna Convention defines a treaty as, quote, an international agreement concluded between states in written form and governed by international law, whether embodied in a single instrument or in two or more related instruments, and whatever its particular designation, end of quote. It is pretty clear to me that from the perspective of international law, from the perspective of the United Nations, that this is in fact a treaty, right? It represents an agreement between states to achieve a particular objective. It was reduced to writing, and that, you know, regardless of the designation, it spelled out rights and obligations among member states. And the real harm, I mean, this is a situation where the mainstream media reporting, I think, has gotten it exactly right, which is to say that the view of Donald Trump blowing up the Iran deal is a victory for hardliners in Iran to be able to turn around and say, yeah, you can't trust the U.S. to keep its word. And certainly is a situation where the president has every right to do so. It was contemplated at the time. You know, we can haul out the opening arguments, elections have consequences, but there will not be a judicial solution to this problem. There will not be a court case, at least not a successful court case, that is going to require the United States to live up to its obligations. It was always contingent on the president's authority, which is delegated to him by a prior act of Congress, to impose or relax sanctions on Iran, subject to the terms of that particular legislation. And being able to reimpose those sanctions is certainly within the power of this president. So, you know, don't elect a criminally insane game show host as president if you don't want to blow up the U.S. obligations. But there we go. That's the answer to that particular question. And in my view, the real harm is, you know, we're talking about international relations, and all of this, as we'll see in the next segment, depends upon something being worth more than the paper that it's printed on.
Oh, man, so many observations about this Iran deal, but I guess they're not really... law observer. They're not really opening arguments material, but I just I hope Macron kind of is happy with himself. Like he kissed Trump's ass for like months and like acted like Trump is the best and they're best friends, and then it didn't even matter because he couldn't get Trump to stick to this deal. So I that was frustrating. And the fact that Trump is simultaneously saying we can't have a deal with Iran about nukes while meeting with North Korea it's a weird juxtaposition. And if it turns out that he's able to negotiate a better Iran deal, then I guess I'll eat my hat. But what I imagine will happen, well, prediction, then we can do Thomas is wrong, is nothing will replace this for, at all. And that'll be the replacement. The replacement to the deal that he, by the way, the complaint was it only, went out 10 years or something like that. It wasn't permanent. So then he'll get rid of it and replace it with nothing. That'll be my prediction. But, I could be wrong. Maybe something different will happen. What do you think?
So, yeah. Two things on that. Number one, I'm going to link in the show notes a Washington Post article that is entitled Fact Checking President Trump's Reason for Leaving the Iranian Nuclear Deal. virtually everything he said about the JCPOA.
I don't think he knows what it is. Do you think he knows anything about the deal? I actually don't think he does.
No, and that's going to be the second point that's a little larger that I want to make. But there are sunsetting provisions in the agreement. It's fairly complicated. It has to do with inspections, and they're like 15 to 25 years out. And again, it makes sense in context, right? And not the least of which is methods for enriching uranium, the types of things you need, right? Like this deal is fairly lengthy. I'm going to include it in the show notes. You should take a look at it. Although, I guess it's just kind of whistling past the graveyard now. But it is things like depending on present technology for how such things are extracted. And, the idea that that it needs to be a permanent feature, number one, doesn't really seem to match up with what I've been able to read from the technological aspect. Again, keeping in mind the enormous disclaimer that I am by no means a nuclear physicist. and number two, and more importantly, it's why I started by reading the goal from the CFR, right? The goal was not to ensure that Iran could never build a nuclear weapon, right? That's not a sensible or sane or serious goal.
It's
not
possible to do that.
It's, exactly. Like you can't, the technology, the knowledge is widely available. The resources are present. The goal is, right, and this is consistent with liberal and conservative foreign policy of the last 75 years, right? The goal is to encourage the peacetime, non-military use of nuclear power as nations see fit, and to make it difficult for nations to convert that peacetime usage of nuclear power into military weapons of mass destruction. And so the sunsetting doesn't answer the fundamental question of, by having these provisions, we've lengthened the breakout time from a couple of weeks to a year. And so you could see, right, and it's apparently within our military espionage capabilities, right? Like when you start enriching uranium, those are things that your satellites can detect, right? And so they would have to remember the breakout time is described by the CFI as sprinting towards producing the fissile material, right? So in other words, if you engage that sprint, you now have engaged in actions that other nations are likely to be able to detect and then can respond accordingly. And so the real difficulty is if somebody can sprint in 3 weeks and have a bomb ready to go before you can do anything about it, right? Military strikes on facilities or things like that, then that's where the real danger comes in. So so those objections don't speak to what the treaty was meant to do. Now, on why we're doing this. And I want to encourage, right, there's a reason we're doing this segment and the next segment back to back in this episode. I want to encourage some kind of consistency in how one approaches foreign policy. And in my view, there are really sort of two predominant poles of thought in terms of foreign policy in the modern world. And the first is the Bill Clinton policy of engagement, right? And the idea is that you bring nations despite human rights violations, despite disagreements with how they're run internally. You bring them into the community of nations and pursue non-military solutions with those nations. And by engaging with them, by trading with them, by spreading capitalism, that tends to diffuse military conflicts. That was absolutely the foreign policy of the Clinton administration. Really good book on that is Thomas Friedman's The Lexus and the Olive Tree. It's dated at this point, but it kind of illustrates that philosophy. The other side is the George W. Bush policy, the neocon policy, right? Spreading democracy at the barrel of a gun, the idea that you go in and forcibly overthrow hostile regimes and try and replace them with democratic ones, and that there are some regimes with which engagement doesn't make sense, that you're really entrenching those in power who haven't got there, who haven't acceded to power in a democratic way and who are, you know, hurting their people. And look, like, a lot of the rhetoric leading up to the Iraq war is rhetoric that I think a lot of us on the left could sign up for, right? That, like, those governments were terrible governments. They were oppressing their own people, that sort of thing. The question is, does it make sense as a matter of foreign policy to radicalize and marginalize those governments, or to try and mainstream and work with those governments? I've made it pretty clear I'm an engagement guy. I think that there is no way. I think you put it really, really well. So I want to kind of delve into that tiny bit of history there. I think there is no way to square, in any kind of coherent foreign policy way, engaging with North Korea but disengaging with Iran, other than the fact that Donald Trump's political base right now is entirely composed of evangelical right-wing fundamentalist Christians, and they tend to support disengagement with Iran because they believe in biblical literalism. Like, you can explain this better than I can. The post-apocalyptic, the running man fallacy. The apocalyptic worldview of biblical literalists. But I don't know if you want to.
And I think another major component is Obama did the Iran deal. So even back before, you know, like, anything, I think Trump's guiding light is Obama equals bad and trying to undo everything Obama ever did. And so with North Korea, it's not like he's undoing any Obama thing per se. But with Iran, he can undo it. So he did.
Yep. I think that's right. So there we go. This is why I think this is a terrible move, because I believe in the engagement view of foreign policy. I believe in making the world more interconnected, not less. And I believe in the U.S. keeping its word when they make international treaties, even if they're not formal treaties that are presented with the advice and consent of the Senate. So there you go.
Interesting. Well, interesting on the legal background there. I wasn't aware of all that. I suppose you could make an argument that the deal should have been, you know, like, if Congress didn't approve it, then we shouldn't have been in it to begin with. I don't know. Is that one of those Congress isn't doing anything anymore kind of arguments?
It is, I would ask the question, and again, you could answer it either way, right? But with our current hyper-partisan state of politics, do we want to be in a position where a party must control the presidency and 60 votes in the Senate in order to conduct foreign policy with other nations, right? Because if what you're saying is we should only do it via treaty, then that's what you're saying, right? Ultimately, we will not have a functional foreign policy coming out of the White House. But will there be exceptions? I think there will be exceptions. For example, as we're going to talk about in the next segment, I think, because this is asymmetric, because Democratic senators will sign on to a treaty with North and South Korea, even if it benefits Donald Trump, I think that, you know, that may be the answer to my question, right? That not all Congresses are going to be like, Mitch McConnell, and are going to say, no, we're just going to oppose everything this president does because we're not going to hand him a victory. It really does highlight, you know, the degree we try and call out when both sides do it, but that was really unprecedented. And so, you know, if the argument in favor of doing it as a treaty is it's not a permanent state of affairs, that everything is broken. And I'm not sure. Not sure how I come out on that. Hey, you guys know that my law practice is dedicated to helping entrepreneurs, small businesses, the kinds of people who tend to hire people. And that's why I'm always excited when we get ZipRecruiter on as a sponsor. ZipRecruiter built a better online job portal. Instead of just posting a job and hoping the right candidate comes along, the ZipRecruiter platform actually learns what you're looking for, identifies candidates with the right experience, and goes out and invites them to apply for your job. That's why, and I know you know the statistic, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter finds good candidates and sends them to you. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. And as I said in the intro, I'm really excited because OA listeners who are small businesses, businesses of any size, I know you're out there. You guys send me emails. You can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just head on over ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter.com/OA. Post your job. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire.
All right. Well, let's transition over to our other foreign policy topic then that you alluded to, the Korean War. Trump ended it with a tweet, sounds like.
No, I think I am very restrained, and I talk about important things.
I'm going to do very restrained if I use it at all. I'm going to do very restrained. I find it tremendous. It's a modern form of communication. There should be nothing you should be ashamed of. It's where it's at.
Yeah. So this is right. Donald Trump tweeted out Korean War to end. And we found out today after
it's definitely. Yeah,
started,
it's not, you know, you don't want to manage expectations at all. You want to going into a meeting, declare Korean War to end. OK.
There is the summit pursuant to this agreement is scheduled for June the 12th. So that news broke during our record because, of course, it did. Mm. So the biggest question I got again was from a lot of folks on the left who are like, oh, come on, like Donald Trump is not going to be able to claim that he ended the Korean War. And I'm going to tell you, we're going to go through some of the history, but Donald Trump may get to send out that tweet. He may be able to say it may be written in the history books that the Korean War ended on Donald Trump's watch due to the unique circumstances surrounding this. And again, consonant with the last segment, this is an unambiguously good development. And if Donald Trump was positive to the process, then great. Right. And I think we need to watch. It's why I'm really, really glad you said what you did. And I think we need to kind of watch the, you know, reflexive, you know, everything that's happened, you know, opposing something just because it has Donald Trump's name attached to it. Now, is he way over? Sure. Right. Right. And we're going to get to that. But no, it's possible. I'm going to link. This is a really, really fun law review. Well, it's fun for me because I like reading law review articles. But
yeah, when you say really, really fun and then law review article.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I know.
But I'm sure our audience is with you. We got a bunch of law geeks here.
So this is an article written in the Akron Law Review by Howard Levy. And Howard Levy is the guy who drafted the armistice that put a halt to the Korean War back in 1953. He was 95 when he wrote the article. Wow. He lived to be 102. He's an unbelievably fascinating guy. And I thought, because there's some really neat legal issues that it might be worth kind of talking about, right? Everybody knows, I think from the news coverage, they've got this correct, that in 1953, the Korean War was paused by an armistice. It was not ended, by a treaty. And that's kind of weird. When you read the armistice, so an armistice is a ceasefire, right? Mm-hmm. And throughout all of human history, you would engage in an armistice so that people aren't shooting at each other, and then you would sit down and hammer out the treaty that would conclude the war. That never happened here. So the first thing to notice is that armistices, That's a fun plural to say. Armistices are signed by the military commanders, right? They are not signed by countries, right? So the armistice that paused the Korean War is signed only by William K. Harrison on behalf of the UN forces. He was a United States military officer, and by Nam Il on behalf of the North Korean and Chinese armies. So why did we only have an armistice and not a treaty? And the answer to that goes all the way back to World War II. Mm. What happened in World War II is that the Korean Peninsula was one of Imperial Japan's Asian acquisitions, right? So they fought a land war of conquest and subjugated the Korean Peninsula when the United States, Britain, and China declared war on Japan. As part of that declaration, they reaffirmed and then later had a subsequent declaration in Cairo between Roosevelt, Churchill, Chiang Kai-shek, that reaffirmed that the aforementioned great powers, quote, mindful of the enslavement of the people of Korea, are determined that in due course, Korea shall become free and independent. Now, you might notice that left out the Soviet Union, the other member of the Allies. That's because the Soviet Union was not at war with Japan for virtually all of World War II. The Soviet Union declared war against Germany, joined the Battle of the Allies, but remained neutral with respect to Japan. And in fact, the deal of their joining the Allies was contingent, Stalin requested, that they be allowed to remain neutral against Japan because Japan had military personnel on the Asian mainland, right, that could attack the Soviet Union. So the deal was they would declare war on Japan only after Germany surrendered. So now go forward in time to 1945. August 6th is when the United States drops an atomic weapon on Hiroshima. And on August 8th, 1945, one day before the Nagasaki bombing, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan and joined in what was called the Potsdam Declaration, which again agreed that, as among other things, that the Allied powers would liberate the Korean Peninsula. So one of the conditions of Japanese surrender would be Japan giving up its overseas possessions, right? It would have to relinquish its hold on the Koreas, in Indochina, in the Philippines, would have to give all that territory back. So August 8th, 1945 is when the Soviet Union joined the war against Japan. Japan surrendered 3 weeks later, right? September 2nd, 1945. So Soviet Union was not in the war against Japan for very long. Yeah. But they were in the war long enough to occupy part of Korea. And so the U.S. Secretary of War drafted what was known as General Order Number 1, which said that as part of the surrender, right? So now you have Allied forces routing out the Japanese from the Asian mainland. And General Order Number 1 set the 38th parallel, which is roughly halfway between what was then Korea, and said that Japanese forces north of the 38th parallel should surrender to the Soviet Union, and Japanese forces south of the 38th parallel should surrender to the Americans. Okay. And that order was sent out to Moscow, was sent out to London, and everybody agreed with the provisions of that general order. That turned into a permanently militarized border that was manned by Soviet troops. It was not meant to be an order dividing the country, but it became that. And so the Soviets kept their troops in Northern Korea after the official surrender of Japan during World War II. And then Allied forces remained in what would become South Korea. Now, go forward a couple of years to 1948, in which the United Nations, as part of the worldwide rebuilding effort, called for supervised elections in Korea. The Soviet troops refused to allow UN forces north of the 38th parallel. So the UN inspectors couldn't get in. They didn't conduct any of the elections in North Korea, and they were unable to verify the results of any ballots. And then North Korea had its own election with no supervisors a couple of weeks later, and that resulted in the election of Kim Il-sung, who was a communist who was trained in Russia. He was the father of Kim Jong-il and the grandfather of the current ruler, Kim Jong-un. So that's what led to the division in Korea that we have today. You had the UN, the Community of Nations, called for free elections in all of Korea. They were kicked out of North Korea, and North Korea elected, quote-unquote, elected Kim Il-sung. And then after those 1948 elections, then there were civil war of incursions on either side of the border for 2 years before North Korea formally invaded South Korea on June 25th, 1950. I want to point out, this is just as an aside, this is a really, really neat historical event. For a very long time, right, you think about how wars get started. Very few people claim, oh yeah, no, we totally started that, right? Like, other than the United States in Iraq, where, you know, we started, because usually it's understood that the people who start the war are the bad guys. So for a long time, there was Soviet disinformation and propaganda claiming that, no, you know, that the South Korean army marched north. And in his autobiography, former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev said this. He said, at the end of 1949, Kim Il-sung arrived with his delegations to hold consultations with Stalin. The North Koreans wanted to prod South Korea with the point of a bayonet. Stalin persuaded Kim Il-sung that he should think it over, make some calculations, and then come back with a concrete plan. Kim went home, and then he returned to Moscow when he had everything worked out. He told Stalin he was absolutely certain of success. I must stress that the war wasn't Stalin's idea, but Kim Il-sung's. And then he goes on to say, for many years, we, meaning the Soviet Union, insisted that the initiative for starting the Korean War came from South Korea. Some say there is no need to correct this version of events because it would be of advantage only to our enemies. I'm telling the truth now for the sake of history. It was the initiative of comrade Kim Il-sung. It was supported by Stalin and many others. In fact, by everybody. So it's kind of rare when you get that. And you know, you don't remember Nikita Khrushchev as being sort of one of the primary villains of the early 80s. I do as a young child. We had, we had a movie called The Day After that postulated a Soviet first
strike.
I've watched
a lot of The Americans, though.
So. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting seeing, one of the villains of history kind of writing, no, it's, I got to set the record straight. Okay. So you have this situation where you have a de facto occupation that exceeds international authority. You have the Soviets training Kim Il-sung and then him launching an offensive invasion into South Korea, which was wildly successful for about 3 weeks. So the day of the invasion, June 25th, the UN passed a declaration requiring the North Korean forces to withdraw. They ignored it. 2 days later, they passed another one. They ignored it. So on June 7th, the UN delegated authority to defend Korea called upon a coalition to put their authority under the command of the United States, who would designate a commander of the unified forces, which we call the UNC, the UN coalition, the United Nations command. And the U.S. put Douglas MacArthur, who was the post-World War II supreme commander for the Allied powers in Japan and commander-in-chief of the Far East Command of the United States. So they gave it to MacArthur. 21 nations were a part of the coalition, but the U.S. supplied 90% of the military personnel. So that's the U.S.'s authority. They're in Korea at the behest of the United Nations under the command of a joint multilateral force that is nevertheless 90% American soldiers. Interesting wrinkle here that ties into the problem is that none of the nations at this time had ratified the Geneva Convention. I know that seems weird, wow. but there were no declaration. There was no formal binding as between any of the nations that were participating in the joint on the joint UN side, and certainly not with the North Korean government, as to the treatment of prisoners of war. So the UN forces immediately said, yes, we intend to abide as if the Geneva Convention were to be enforced. And so did the North Koreans. That did not happen.
At what point do we get to MASH?
As
do
a
we
part
have to go through
of,
all of the plot of MASH? Are we at that part yet?
Yeah, we're really close. as a part of the North Korean incursion, right? They sort of blitzkrieged all the way down and occupied almost all of the Korean Peninsula until the UNC forces arrived. They impressed tens of thousands of soldiers into the North Korean army, which is a violation of the Geneva Convention. So they forced South Koreans to fight for the North Koreans and to augment their forces and kept discipline in their military camps with military officers threatening to shoot their own, you know, quote unquote conscripts. That's going to be really, really important, because then what happens is then the UN comes in and under MacArthur, within several months, they have decimated most of the North Korean army at the landing at Incheon and pushed the North Korean army all the way back north of the 38th parallel. They occupied the capital. They had pretty much conquered the entire peninsula, and then the Chinese forces entered the war on the North Korean side and were able to push the UNC forces down to, again, about the 38th parallel. And that's where the war stayed in a stalemate and became kind of a war of attrition, where, you know, both sides would make incursions. They would gain a few kilometers of land here, lose a few kilometers there, but never really made any permanent gains after that. As a result of the UNC advance, the UN forces under the command of the US seized 140,000 prisoners of war, right? Which is just a staggering number. MacArthur was relieved of his command for reasons that are beyond the scope of this section. He was replaced with Matthew Ridgway. And here's what Matthew Ridgway said in his notes. He said, as early as January 6th, 1951, I became sufficiently concerned with the problems of what to do about the prisoners of war in our custody to include the subject in my letter to General MacArthur. What we were faced with had me worried was the presence close to the fighting zone of some 140,000 prisoners of war whom we had to feed, water, guard, and care for. It took a substantial fraction, which we could ill spare, of our armed forces just to guard the compounds, and it took much of our scant transportation to carry supplies to feed and clothe and house them. And I could go on, but see how the obligation to treat the prisoners of war humanely created this amazing military snafu. And the problem is, you've got 140,000 prisoners of war. You know, many of them are South Koreans. They are not loyal to the North Korean government, right? They would not fight on behalf of North Korea if released. But how do you figure that out? How can you tell, right? You can't just say, okay, who promises never to shoot us, right? Like, because, you know, then the North Koreans are going to, oh yeah, no, we totally promised not to shoot you, right? So you had this unbelievable mess involving how to treat an inordinate amount, a disproportionately huge amount of POWs. And again, that was caused by the North Korean army's impressing of soldiers into, you know, at gunpoint into their army, right? So it was 1951 when the sides first started talking armistice. And the reason they first started talking that was because the war was at a stalemate, right? You had the Chinese army in there. You had the US army in there. Now you had two large powers with large modern militaries fighting each other, trench warfare, going back and forth. And it was clear that this was going to be a stalemate. So they were looking for a solution. And the solution broke down over the question of how do you treat the POWs? Because what North Korea and China said was, will you send back POWs to their home country? And what the POWs were saying was, I don't want to be sent back to the country in which I was captured, the army for which I was fighting. So the U.S. and the U.N. held out for what they called voluntary repatriation, right? Which was, and this wound its way into the ultimate armistice, that within 60 days after the armistice became effective, each side shall, without offering any hindrance, directly repatriate and hand over in groups all those prisoners of war in its custody who insist on repatriation to the side which they belonged at the time of capture. So they ultimately got the right of the prisoners to refuse. You can understand how, you know, on the flip side, right, voluntary repatriation was always, you know, kind of a non-starter, because the idea is, you know, if your captor is pointing a gun at you going, do you want to go home or do you want to stay here? Right. Like that there's a heavy implicit level of coercion, but it was so bad in Korea that ultimately, you know, that was the sticking point and that was the negotiation. And that's why they signed the armistice agreement in 1953. And as a result, it's why they were never able to formalize the armistice into a treaty. It called for subsequent treaty, right? It said within 90 days that there will be a meeting and we'll hammer out, you know, quote, the Korea problem. They had that meeting in 1954, and the U.S. didn't try to push for a formal treaty at that time. The reasons are complicated from a historical basis. It had to do with our other problem in what was then called Indochina, which became the war in Vietnam. And so the U.S. wasn't interested in pursuing a formal treaty at that point. In 1956, the United States announced its intention to move nuclear weapons into North Korea, which ultimately they did in 1958. That violates paragraph 13D of the armistice. Paragraph 13D of the armistice prevents anybody, it says, we will cease the introduction into Korea of reinforcing combat aircraft, armored vehicles, weapons, and ammunition, provided that you could replace worn out ones, but they may only be replaced, quote, on the basis piece for piece of the same effectiveness and the same type, end of quote. And in 1958, the United States said, nope, you know what? We're going to put what they called Matador cruise missiles armed with atomic warheads that were designed to reach China and the Soviet Union and other 280 millimeter atomic cannons, something called Honest John missiles. I have no idea what that is. But the idea was, as part of the growing Cold War, the United States used its military presence in South Korea to place nuclear weapons and in clear violation of the armistice. So as a result, North Korea, and again, I don't want to be on the side of defending North Korea. At multiple times, they've claimed that the armistice is not binding on it.
They have an okay argument if the US was the ones who broke it first.
Yep. They have a pretty decent argument, and they reiterated that multiple times. In 2006, North Korea conducted a nuclear weapons test, which obviously is in violation of the armistice. In 2013, they shut down all communication with South Korea and again disclaimed that the armistice had any kind of lasting operative effect and reiterated again the blame on the United States for refusing to convert the armistice into a formal treaty. So now what do we have? We have the Panmunjom Declaration, in which both sides agree that they will work to remove nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula, that it reopens the communications that were shut down in 2016. The South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, will visit Pyongyang in North Korea in the fall. But then most importantly, that they're going to convert the armistice into a formal treaty.
And this was all accomplished by calling Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man, right? Isn't that
what? This was accomplished over 15 years of negotiations between
South Korea,
North and South Korea. But nevertheless, look, like I wanted to read some of those provisions because I want to say two things to it. Number one, I want to emphasize that it's an unambiguously good thing. And number two, I want to point out just how close in language it is to the language that Donald Trump and his Republican allies have mocked in the Iranian deal, right? The the Iranian deal has UN sanctions. It has UN inspectors inspecting sites in Iran to ensure that they're not producing centrifuges, that they're not enriching uranium in such a way as to produce sufficient quantities of fissile material. This, on the other hand, says we share a common goal of not having any nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula.
It's so even weaker, isn't it?
It's significantly weaker, right? It is absolutely, and again, it's one of which
it's a bad deal. I've never seen a deal so bad.
It's if it were a Democratic president on whose watch this accord were signed, I would say this is an unambiguously good thing. It's an unambiguously good thing. But to suggest that the Iranian deal was bad because it didn't have specifics attached to it, but this is a good deal, is not a tenable position.
Yeah.
It's not an argument you can make.
Obviously.
So there will be, starting June 12th, treaty discussions. Those are either, the accords allow it to be either trilateral, right, between North and South Korea and the United States, or quadrilateral between North and South Korea, the United States, and China, with, quote, a view to declaring an end to the war and establishing a permanent and solid peace regime. And
yeah, he may, yeah, I think I agree with you, though, that Trump may end up with that credit of this war ended during his presidency. I'm curious, too, he must have done, or the administration, I guess, deserves some credit for these hostages being released. Just for fun, I actually tuned into Fox News last night.
Oh, wow.
And it was horrifying and disturbing, but they had to make rock soup out of these hostages. It was wall-to-wall, 12-hour coverage of how Trump got these hostages released. It was like countdown to the hostages, just nonstop. It was amazing. Like, it just was such a big production. And it's a good thing. But it just goes to show that when Trump has like one legitimate accomplishment, they have to milk it for weeks of all it's worth.
Yeah. No, I agree. But you know, I think it's worth saying what we said. So.
Absolutely. Well, I didn't know we were going to get the Ken Burns Korean War documentary, but that was
I just
was
thought
really
there were so many neat legal things. And every time I went to try and explain, well, like, why isn't it a treat? Well, okay, because the treatment of prisoners of war. Well, why did that happen? And it just, I got a little far down the rabbit hole, but
that was really fascinating. Cool. I'm just poking fun at
you.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Always.
It's all good.
And I believe you did it all in one sentence with repeated clauses.
Semicolons.
Whereas North Korea and South Korea, no. Okay, well, that was very fascinating. Thanks for the breakdown. And now it is time for our co-favorite segment of the week, and that is when we've got to thank our new patrons. And our new patrons at patreon.com/law are David Gould, Chris Torres Olson, Wanda Wanda, Michael Hatch, Ian Mansfield, Monica, SI Skeptic, Jacqueline M. is a hottie, Lou Larmouth, Janine, Alan Andrews, Seth Flory, Jonathan, George Green, Eric Sims, M. Brown, Lumpy Space Prince, John Oliver's writing staff. I knew it. You revealed your plan, John Oliver's writing staff. Matt McMahon, Matt Winland. Well, they were aware he was wearing the hat. Oh, that's the bar case, right?
Yep, that's great.
Well, they were wearing that. That was a great line. Justin Berry, Trish Barron, Keith K, Sarah, Matt Shannon, and Brandon Price.
All right. And thank you to Matthew McNulty, Beverly Thunis, Michael Q. Arsvold, Jack Coffison, Shoot Pool Not People. I agree with that. Daniel F. Moust, Mike Bifulco, Kidnapping People to Prevent Declawing and Ear Docking. God-awful movie shout out there. Drew Schaefer, Joe Thackeray, Jeff Bisty, Elizabeth Name, Thomas Buchanan, Sharks Will Never Win a Stanley Cup. Biter Candy. I don't know if that's meant to be bitter or biter, but either way, we'll thank both Bitter Candy and Biter Candy. John McKay, Jordan Galash, My Buddy Isn't a Doll, damn it. Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Brian Studwell, Rob Moore, Ian McPhee, Nicholas Porter, John Rhodes, Michelle Cloud, Mikolig Jezvaded, Evil Al. Yeah, well, yeah. About time we got some evil support. Brent Casey and John Binet Ramsey. Nice. Oof. I should point out that is spelled R-A-M-Z-E-E. So it's not.
So it's not the real John Binet Ramsey, apparently is what not. You're saying?
So thanks to all of you for supporting us over at patreon.com/law. You want to join their ranks, get a shout out from us, pledge as little as $1 an episode. Come on, help us out. You know you want to.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. Thanks so much. And now it is time for TGBE, the impossible question that even Andrew got wrong. But did I somehow luck into a right answer? I think not, because if my answer was right, I feel like you would have gotten it right. So let's find out what the right answer is.
Okay. So, just a reminder on the question. This is a contract between the landowner who engages a contractor to build a building and pave the sidewalk for $200,000. Later, the landowner and the contractor entered into what is described in the problem as an oral modification under which the contractor doesn't have to pave the sidewalk anymore, but does still have to build the building. Landover turns over the $200,000 after the contractor builds the building and then says, you didn't build the sidewalk. Has the contractor breached the contract? So let's go through this. The way you did, you eliminated first the no answer of no, because the oral modification was in good faith and therefore enforceable. That's a good elimination. It is not an enforceable oral modification. So A, not the correct answer. And you also eliminated C, which, by the way, is the answer I would have given and gotten incorrect. Ooh. So the C answer was yes, because the parole evidence rule bars proof of the oral modification. Your reason for eliminating that was, I don't know what the parole evidence rule is, which is a good reason to eliminate it.
Well, not quite, but go ahead. No, it was, I didn't understand the wording of bars proof of the oral modification. I didn't understand that.
Yeah. So here's what that is, right? The parole evidence rule says that when you have a written contract, that you may not introduce extrinsic evidence in order to vary, modify, or contradict the terms of the written agreement. Okay. So when it says bars proof of the oral modification, if the oral modification intended.
Okay, yeah. Hold on. Doesn't it just bar oral modification then? Why does it bar proof of the oral modification?
Because of the distinction.
I thought I just put Andrew Bott into a
you did. Because this is a really hairline distinction here. It does not bar the oral modification of a contract, right? That goes to when you want to modify a contract, that is different than when you want to interpret a contract. The parole evidence rule is a rule of interpretation. This is something that I know, by the way, but it's something that, again, because this is a very hairline distinction, tripped me up as I was going sort of quickly through the question. I was like, oh, yeah, right. That's a parole evidence. We're not going to introduce the evidence to contradict. So therefore, you've still got to perform your obligations on the contract. This isn't a question about interpreting the contract. This is the question about whether the contract was superseded, right? And that means it comes down to B versus D, which is exactly what you said. Right. It's going to come down.
So far, I'm a better lawyer than Andrew.
So far, you are a better lawyer than me. That is correct. It is between, right? The subsequent oral modification is not valid because it's in order to discharge the duty under the contract, it must be in writing, which is answer B, which you chose, or answer D, that the subsequent oral modification is not binding because there is no consideration, which is answer D. And here, I'm sad to say, we're now on the same footing, that it is, in fact, answer D. You can modify a contract at common law orally. You can, under the Uniform Commercial Code, it is required to be in writing, but this is not a UCC contract. And you can discharge somebody. To discharge a contractual duty just means that that person no longer has to perform that obligation. And there are lots of reasons why contractual obligations get discharged, right? Like because the other side is breached, because of mutual agreement, because there's an order of the court, all sorts of things like that. So you can do all of that without it being in writing. So B is not a correct statement of law. What is a correct statement of law is that in order to have an enforceable contract, in order to modify a contract, you go back to the same requirements for making a contract in the first place. There must be offer, there must be acceptance, and there must be consideration. And here, the landowner just says, oh yeah, you know what? You don't have to pave the sidewalk after all, but I'll still give you the full $200,000. And in that case, the courts are going to say—
That is so weird that that's the reason that it's not valid. I really don't understand
If it were the case, if they said, oh, well, I'll take $5 off, right? If there were—
There's a quarter in my pocket.
Yep.
Then that would make it—
Then it would make it
see,
valid.
See, that's stupid, and I think I picked the better answer.
I actually think— I agree
I'm not here to answer the law. I'm here to tell you what's the right answer.
I agree with you, and I will point out that's exactly why the UCC has changed the requirements.
Oh, I thought it was under the UCC.
Yeah, there you go. That's why. Probably. That's the correct—
I have encyclopedic knowledge of the UCC, and I applied it to this.
You correctly exposed a tension at common law, which is that it makes no sense to, on the one hand, have the parole evidence rule prevents you from orally modifying the terms of a of introducing evidence of other oral communications to modify or vary or contradict the terms of a written agreement. For all the reasons that we've talked about on this show at great length and, you know, that comprise my day-to-day job, it makes no sense to have a strong parole evidence rule and at the same time allow an oral modification to a contract to say, we're not going to let you interpret the contract right, by talking about the conversation you have, but we are going to let you say, no, we subsequently repudiated that contract and he let me out of the duty. And the evidence for that is stuff that he said, right? It's the same problem that the parole evidence rule was meant to solve, but it's coming in through the back door. So I like your analysis.
Well, Andrew and I got this one wrong. You know, that's— Andrew was wrong on this one. And then also I was right, but still wrong. So I want to note here just quickly to patrons that some people aren't aware of this, that we don't actually own a time machine. So if we ever give you an early episode, you'll get a little filler space for when we later record the winner of TTB. But I just say something because every time we release an early episode, people are— we get like one or two complaints that like, hey, where was the winner? It's like, we don't actually have a time machine. That's a goof that we do. Just so you know, there's no actual time machine here. But that being said, Andrew, why don't you hop in your time machine and tell us who the winner of TTB is, who bested both of us, the two best lawyers in the land, you and I, beat us both.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice...
Well, Thomas, a lot of folks played along this week, and most were split pretty evenly between A, the attractive distractor answer, and D, the right answer. A few other lawyers like me were also tripped up and guessed C for the reasons that I said earlier. My favorite non-winning answer is from Jeffrey Skarsky, who says, gotta go with D. I can't enforce a contract that Andrew will read my answer this week if it doesn't say I'll do anything for him, like become a patron, which I will if he does. But he didn't win, so that's obviously not an enforceable contract. Sorry, you should become a patron anyway, though. No, our winning answer comes from Andrew Besner, that is at @the_BESNER on Twitter, Andrew Besner, who says, D, a contract without consideration is a promise, and me promising you don't have to abide by our written contract isn't legally enforceable, just like you promising me never-ending fame and fortune isn't enforceable. Really succinct, great explanation, exactly right. Everyone give Andrew Besner a follow on Twitter. That's @the_BESNER. Congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And thank you for Andrewing. And boy, do I really need to get a question right. I think it's been three or four that I've gotten wrong in a row. And my legal status. No, that's not the right word. What my practice is at stake.
we got to protect those clients, Thomas.
Yeah, exactly. We will see you for another Rapid Response Friday. Oh, and one last plug again. Please check out my upcoming talk at NOSHA. That's NOSHA, NOSHA.info. If you're anywhere near New Orleans, please consider coming and saying hi and listening to the talk and meeting Baby Opening Arguments and Lydia and having a great time. So thank you for that. And unless you have any pending announcements, then we will see you on
no,
Friday.
No, everyone go see Thomas. You won't regret it.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.